Part 9, Going West in 1855. St. Louis, February 1855. St. Louis is booming. In 1845, the town had a population of roughly 15,000 residents, and over the course of 10 years, the population had exploded to nearly 80,000 residents. It became the nation's second largest trading port. Why did this landlocked town grow so quickly? Well, because it's conveniently located at the point where the Missouri River splits west from the Mississippi and flows all the way through Kansas City. By 1855, the railroad had finally arrived in the city, and it was the westernmost railroad stop in the United States. St. Louis's rise began really in 1849 with the California Gold Rush, when thousands of enterprising Americans needed to sail up the Missouri River to meet with the Oregon Trail near Kansas City. Then, in 1854, Kansas becomes an organized territory, and the government was selling plots of land along the Oregon Trail at $1.50 an acre, and thousands more will funnel through St. Louis to stake their claim in the Great Plains. Among this new wave of American settlers were five of John Brown's sons, John Jr., Jason, Frederick, Salmon, and Owen. The two oldest brothers, John Jr. and Jason, are going to take the safer, more popular route via railroad to St. Louis because they were both married with children, while the younger sons were driving a herd of cattle to Kansas via Illinois, Iowa, and Nebraska. To take a herd of cattle around Missouri back then would almost double the travel time. However, Missouri is still a slave state, and despite its proximity to the North, Missouri had the strictest slave codes in the country, worse even than Mississippi. And that's a category nobody wants to find themselves in. Worse than Mississippi. So, in 1855, any Yankee cowboys caught in Missouri were likely to be robbed or even killed. And between the five Brown brothers, that herd of 11 Devon cattle and three horses were their most valuable assets. Everything else they owned was sold for cash to pay for their western settlement. There was no going back to Ohio. Like thousands of other Americans, the Browns would gamble everything to settle in the West or die in the attempt. So in February 1855, John Brown Jr. is sitting on a train next to his wife, Wealthy Brown, and on his lap is his only son, John III. The porter makes his way down the passenger car yelling, "Last stop, St. Louis! Last stop coming up!" John is relieved. The journey from his old home in Ohio had taken more than 5 days. That was 5 days of crowded railway stations, even more crowded rail cars, constant smoke and noise. This incessant screeching and chugging had given poor John Jr. a headache, and not to mention the novelty of riding a train for the first time had worn off on his 3-year-old son, who was becoming restless and grumpy. Still, though, John Jr. had to be impressed by the experience. 10 years earlier, that same trip between Akron, Ohio and St. Louis, Missouri would have taken weeks. As a teenager, John Jr. saw the first rail lines being built in Ohio. It wasn't until he was in his 20s before he rode a train for the first time, and now he was being rocketed on a steel beast at 40 miles an hour across America. Looking out his window, he could follow miles and miles of brand new telegraph wires running along the tracks, which would send messages instantaneously over vast distances. The author, Adam Goodhart, puts it the best. With these telegraph lines, for the first time in American history, events which took place in the morning in Virginia became news in Chicago that same afternoon. Through communication and transportation, the U.S. was becoming more and more interconnected than ever before. Everything that is east of the Mississippi River. All other news taking place in the West would have to travel by foot, horse, or steamship to St. Louis before anyone back east would hear about it. The train John Jr. is riding on rolls over the Mississippi River. The Browns had just exited Illinois and entered Missouri, from free state to a slave state. Though on paper, railroad and steamship was the safest method of travel, the Browns still knew they needed to keep a low profile while in Missouri. But finally, the train rolls into the station in the heart of St. Louis. and the city then truly was the gateway to the West, as thousands of settlers were being funneled from the trains to the steamships to continue their westward journey, and vice versa. St. Louis was the last stop of civilization, and it provided all of the comforts and supplies one might need to stake their claim out in Kansas. Once off the train, John Jr. meets up with his younger brother Jason and his wife and two sons who were traveling in a different car. The brothers were relieved to see each other, mostly because Jason's four-year-old son Austin and John III were good friends and they could keep each other occupied while the adults took care of more important business. While the wives were watching the children, John and Jason go to the freight car and unload all of their belongings. John Jr. had a couple of chests filled with clothes, some books, a squirrel rifle, and a little pistol. And Jason pulled out his chest, a squirrel rifle, and two large boxes, one filled with fruit trees, the other filled with grapevines. Jason was hoping to plant them on his new farm in Kansas. But that was it. That was all of the belongings between the two young families. Three large suitcases, three little guns, a couple of fruit trees, and some grapevines. While in St. Louis, John and Jason need to purchase the rest of their supplies before departing on a steamship, so they purchase a plow, some small farming implements, seed, two small tents, and a corn mill. The two families then make their way to the river docks where they purchase their tickets for the steamship, the New Lucy, which would take them up the Missouri River to Kansas City. But while John Jr. was tying off his freight on the deck, an ominous feeling starts to come over him. A box of fruit trees and grapevines, which my brother Jason had brought from Ohio, our plow, and a few agricultural implements we had on the deck of that steamer looked lonesome. For these were all we could see, which were adapted to the occupations of peace. Though the steamship was packed with over 100 travelers, the Browns were the only ones who actually planned on settling and farming in the West. It's only when John Brown starts looking at the other fellow passengers that he realizes the danger that he has just put his family in. He describes the other passengers like this. The ship was crowded with passengers, mostly men from the South bound for Kansas. That they were from the South was plainly indicated by their language and dress, while their drinking, profanity, and display of revolvers and bowie knives, openly worn as an essential part of their makeup, clearly showed the class to which they belonged, and their mission was to aid in the establishing of slavery in Kansas. The men John Brown Jr. is describing on this boat are a group of people that we refer to as the Missouri Ruffians. An English traveler, making his way through Kansas at the same time, described these same group of men like this.
And these were men, for the most part, of large frame, with red flannel shirts and immense boots worn outside of their trousers, their faces unwashed and unshaven, still reeking with the dust and smoke from their last attack, wearing their most savage looks and giving utterance to the most horrible imprecations and blasphemies, armed moreover to the teeth with rifles and revolvers, cutlasses and bowie knives.
And John Jr. realizes he and his brother loaded their families on a boat filled to the brim with these Missouri ruffians. So who or what is a Missouri ruffian? Well, they were, of course, mostly men of Missouri, though many came from Alabama. They were a kind of paramilitary club which conducted itself similarly to a militia. And as John Jr. pointed out, these men had no plans on settling the lands of Kansas. But instead, they would make their way through the territory, attacking, pillaging, harassing, and intimidating settlers from northern states. These men, for the most part, were not slave owners themselves, though many of them were employed in some aspect of the slave trade in Missouri. They mostly saw themselves as future plantation owners, future slave owners, and future men of wealth and prestige, even though the vast majority of them would never own a slave, a plantation, or become wealthy in any way. They did, however, receive financial support and encouragement from the wealthy plantation owners of the South. John Jr. later on reflects, "Then for the first time arose in my mind the query, must the fertile prairies of Kansas, through a struggle at arms, be first secured to freedom before free men can reap and sow? If so, how poorly we were prepared for such work will be seen when I say that for arms, five of us brothers had only two small squirrel rifles and one revolver. But there was nothing to be done for the family. The fare had been paid, and they could little afford any other means to travel to Kansas. The Browns had little time to change their minds anyway, because the new Lucy abruptly leaves St. Louis with great haste to escape another invader that had made its way into the city. An enemy equally hated on both sides of the Mason-Dixon. Cholera. Hearing about the outbreak, the captain pulls full steam ahead out of St. Louis, but it was too late. The disease had already made its way onto the ship. Within a few days, dozens of passengers had already died. After 2 days of travel, Jason Brown's oldest son, Austin, a 4-year-old little boy, had contracted the disease. And within 2 days, he died. The next day, the new Lucy was wading through a treacherously shallow part of the Missouri River. It ran aground, and they were forced to make an emergency stop in the small town of Waverly, Missouri, to repair their damaged rudder. That evening, it began to rain. But still, the Browns took the opportunity to take Austin's body off of the boat. The Browns made their way outside of the town, their lonely way illuminated only by the lightning of a furious thunderstorm. They buried Austin next to a small tree. They said a short prayer for the poor soul and returned to the boat. But when they got back, however, they found that all of their freight had been carelessly dumped on the deck. The new Lucy had left this mourning northern family standing in the rain. At massive personal expense, the Brown family had to make their way to Kansas by stagecoach. John Jr. writes more about this journey.
Before we reached there, however, we became very hungry and endeavored to buy food at various farmhouses on the way. But the occupants, judging from our speech that we were not from the South, always denied us, saying, "We have nothing for you."
And it was like arriving at the shores of a vast ocean of gentle hills and grass. From there, the Browns would have to make their way by foot, trudging all of their belongings along with them. After 2 days of walking, John and Jason will meet up with their three cattle-driving brothers at a place sitting 8 miles from the town of Osawatomie. The five brothers would occupy a stretch of 2 miles of land, which would eventually become known as Brown's Run or Brownsville. The Browns had arrived in late March of 1855, just in time for the territory's first major election. On March 30th, 1855, the residents of Kansas would vote on a legislature that would craft the territory's constitution. On March 30th, 1855, the question of slavery in Kansas Territory would be answered once and for all. On March 30th, 1855, the Protestant farming, free soil, northern majority would crush the prospect of slavery in Kansas once and for all. Or so they thought. Part 10, How to Win an Election in Kansas. March 30th, 1855, it's 6 a.m. in the town of Lawrence, Kansas Territory. A few years earlier, Lawrence was just a small village, but by 1855, it had become the most bustling town in Wakarusa County with more than 400 inhabitants. It was the main crossroads for northern free soil settlers and a hub for anti-slavery sentiment. Lawrence is home to the territory's first abolitionist newspaper, the Kansas Herald of Freedom. And construction on the Grand Free State Hotel was nearly complete. That morning, the two election judges, Mr. Abbott and Mr. Reeder, were preparing the polling place for the vote, when an army is heard marching towards Lawrence. Just outside of Lawrence, over 1,000 Missouri ruffians were marching on the town. They were heavily armed with rifles, pistols, and knives. They were also accompanied by two cannons filled with musket balls. This massive force had marched 2 days from Missouri to vote in the Kansas elections. The leader of the massive posse told Abbott and Blanton their intentions. Blanton nervously insisted that he is bound to execute the duties of his office and required that any of the Missouri men who wished to vote that day must simply take the oath of residency. The ruffians occupying the town awkwardly looked at each other. They had no intentions of residing in the territory. They had just planned on popping over to Kansas Territory for the weekend, voting, then returning home to Missouri the next day. Bada bing. One of the ruffians, who went by the name Colonel Young, tried bribing Blanton with cash and some booze. Blanton refused. Then Colonel Young pulled a rope out and threatened to hang him. Blanton did accept that offer, and he vacated the premises. Mr. Abbott immediately resigned as well. Instead, a man named Robert Cummins was appointed the new election judge. Cummins proclaimed that a man has a right to vote if he's been in the territory but an hour, and voting in the town of Lawrence commenced. Two actual residents of the town attempted to vote that day, and both were chased from the polling place by the ruffians. One was shot at a number of times, but nobody was seriously hurt. The town quietly surrendered their right to vote that day without anyone getting killed. After the ruffians finished their voting in Lawrence, a detachment of roughly 400 Missouri men left to go vote again in a smaller nearby town. Meanwhile, in Topeka, a smaller yet far more drunk and rowdy group of ruffians was occupying its streets. The election judge there, Mr. Burgess, was refusing to count the ruffians' votes when one of the mob walks up to Burgess, points his pistol at his head. The ruffian pulls back the hammer and pulls the trigger. Snap! Mr. Burgess winces. The entire crowd starts laughing at him. The barrel was empty. But again, the Missouri man pulls back the hammer on his pistol. He pulls the trigger a second time. Snap! The crowd laughed even harder at Mr. Burgess's wincing. A second man then came behind Burgess and hit him on the back of the head with a club. Disoriented, on the floor, Mr. Burgess resigns his office. Two drunken members of the mob appointed themselves secretaries and nominated a third member of the mob to be the new judge. The vote was unanimous from the Missouri ruffians, and they commenced with voting in Topeka. Not long after that, an elderly resident of Topeka approached the ballot box. The ruffians looked on. He grumpily announced to the crowd that he would not vote on matters having to do with slavery, but he was going to practice his constitutional right and duty that day. The crowd looked on silently as the man made his way into the voting booth. A few moments later, the old man exited and began walking through the mob back home. One ruffian then knocked his hat off, a second punched him in the head, sending the elderly man to the ground, and a third of the party put his foot on the old man's neck and pointed his gun at the man's head. Again, the mob laughed. He was released and escaped, but that man was the only Topeka resident to vote in the election on that day. At the same time, in the town of Bloomington, Kansas Territory, a man named John Wakefield and another election judge are held up in their polling place. John Wakefield was guarding the ballot books, while the other was guarding the ballot box. They had barricaded the doors, so the mob of ruffians outside began shattering the windows. One Missourian named Jones told the judge they had 5 minutes to resign or they'll die. The 5 minutes came and went. This man Jones gave them one more minute. 1 minute goes by. The door was kicked open. One of the judges passes out, and the ballot box was quickly seized. But John Wakefield will escape out the back door with the ballot books in his pocket. The old man runs as fast as he can to his friend's home. The Missouri ruffians were in hot pursuit. John Wakefield tells the rest of the story.
I ran into the house and told Mr. Ramsey to give me his double-barreled shotgun. The mob rode up, and I should think a dozen or more presented their pistols at me. I drew up the gun at Jones, the leader. We stood that way perhaps for a minute. A man professing to be my friend undertook to take the gun from me, saying, "If you shoot, we will all be killed. We can't fight this army." My reply was to stand off or I would shoot him, which he did. Then one of my friends spoke in a very calm manner and said, "Judge, you had better surrender. We cannot fight this army without arms." I then said I must know the conditions and remarked to the mob, "Gentlemen, what do you want with me?" Someone said, "We want you to go back to the polls and state whether it was not you that persuaded the judges to take away the poll books. I said I would easily say no, for I could not get in hearing of the judges. But if I could have, I should have done it. I said I would go back, but I would go alone. I went back and got upon a wagon and made them a short speech. I told them I was an old soldier. I had fought through two wars for the rights of my country, and I thought I had a privilege there on that day. I said they were in the wrong, that we were not abolitionists as they presented to us to be, but were free state men, that they were abusing us unjustly and that their acts were contrary to organic law and the Constitution of the United States. Then a man cried out while I was speaking several times, "Shoot him! Shoot him! He's too saucy!" When I got through and got down from the wagon, a man came up and told me he wanted to tie a white ribbon in my buttonhole or the boys would kill me. I first refused, but he insisted, and I let him do it. Then I turned around and cut it out with my knife. Then I made an attempt to leave, when they cried out, "Stay with us and vote. We don't want you to leave." And I thanked them, but told them they could have it to themselves then. I should leave them. And I went.
A Missouri newspaper reported that a force of between 5,000 and 7,000 men had departed Missouri to go vote in Kansas on that day. The most liberal estimate of the amount of eligible voters living in the territory of the time wouldn't have been any more than 3,000. Yet, 6,332 votes were cast. Unsurprisingly, all but one of the territory's new legislators were pro-slavery candidates. The one free soil candidate immediately resigns his office on the grounds that the legislator was completely illegal. Besides, if he would have stayed on as a legislature, he surely would have been killed. The free soil residents will refer to this legislative body as the bogus legislature. However, Governor Reeder, appointed by President Franklin Pierce, recognizes the legislative body, and they begin crafting the territory's very first constitution. In that constitution was the strictest slave code the United States of America had ever seen. Chapter 151 of the Kansas Territory's first territorial constitution. Slaves, an act to punish offenses against slave property. Section 3. If any free person shall by speaking, writing, or printing advise, persuade, or induce any slaves to rebel, conspire against, or murder any citizens of this territory, or shall bring into print, write, publish, or circulate, or cause to be brought into printed, written, published, or circulated, or shall knowingly aid or assist in the bringing into printing, writing, publishing, or circulating in this territory any book, pamphlet, paper, magazine, or circular for the purpose of exciting insurrection, rebellion, revolt, or conspiracy on the part of the slave, free Negroes, or mulattoes against the citizens of the territory, or any part of them, such person shall be guilty of felony and suffer death. Section 4. If any person shall entice, decoy, or carry away out of this territory any slave belonging to another, with intent to deprive the owner thereof of the services of such slave, or with intent to affect or procure the freedom of such slave, he shall be adjudged guilty of grand larceny, and on conviction thereof shall suffer death or be imprisoned at hard labor for not less than 10 years. Section 5. If any person shall aid or assist in enticing, decoying, persuading, or carrying away or sending out of this territory any slave belonging to another, with intent to effect or procure freedom for such slave, or with intent to deprive the owner thereof of the services of such slave, he shall be adjudged guilty of grand larceny, and on conviction thereof he shall suffer death or be imprisoned at hard labor for not less than 10 years.
Section 6. If any person shall entice, decoy, or carry away out of any state or other territory of the United States any slave belonging to another with intent to procure or effect the freedom of such slave or to deprive the owners thereof of the services of such slave and shall bring such slave into this territory, he shall be adjudged guilty of grand larceny in the same manner as if such slave had been enticed, decoyed, or carried away out of this territory, and in such case, the larceny may be charged to have been committed in any county of this territory into or through which such slave shall have been brought by such person. On conviction thereof, the person offending shall suffer death or be imprisoned at hard labor for not less than 10 years. Section 11. If any person print, write, introduce into, publish, or circulate, or cause to be brought into, printed, written, published, or circulated, or shall knowingly aid or assist in bringing into printing, publishing, or circulating within this territory any book, paper, pamphlet, magazine, handbill, or circular containing any statements, arguments, opinions, sentiment, doctrine, advice, or innuendo calculated to produce a disorderly, dangerous, or rebellious dissatisfaction among the slaves of this territory, or to induce such slaves to escape from the service of their masters, or resist their authority, he shall be guilty of felony and be punished by imprisonment at hard labor for a term not less than 5 years. Section 12. If any free person, by speaking or by writing, assert or maintain that persons have not the right to hold slaves in this territory, or shall introduce into this territory, print, publish, write, circulate, or cause to be printed, published, written, circulated, or introduced into this territory any book, paper, magazine, pamphlet, or circular containing any denial of the right of a person to hold slaves in this territory, such person shall be deemed guilty of felony and punished by imprisonment at hard labor for a term not less than 2 years. Section 13. No person who is consciously opposed to holding slaves or who does not admit the right to hold slaves in this territory shall sit as a juror on the trial of any persecution, of any violation of any of the sections of this act.
In this territorial constitution, the responsibility for enforcing these strict laws was put in the hands of the Missouri ruffians. The Free Soil majority in the territory refused to recognize this bogus legislature. Meetings were held throughout the territory, and community leaders immediately wrote to the New England Emigrant Aid Societies. These aid societies were set up by Northern philanthropists to provide money and encourage Northern families to settle in the new territory. But following the election on March 30th, they took on a new task of purchasing guns and ammunition and smuggling those guns into the territory so the settlers could better defend themselves against the attacking Missouri forces. And John Brown Jr. will send a letter to his father, John Brown, detailing the vicious miscarriage of justice which had taken place. He asked his dad to also send guns and ammunition so the Brown families could defend themselves against the ruffians as well. John Brown agreed that his sons and their families required weapons, so he taps into his good friend Garrett Smith, who orders rifles, pistols, through the Springfield Arms Company. Also, about 50 artillery swords were donated to John Brown. These swords were antique military surplus left over from the War of 1812, but Brown will also provide what he thought was the most potent and valuable weapon against the pro-slavery forces in Kansas, and that was his own body. For John Brown had been planning and preparing for his own slave war in Virginia, but there was a real war currently being fought out west on the American frontier, and John Brown was about to become a soldier in the war that we know today as Bleeding Kansas. Next time on John Brown's Body. John Brown will disguise himself as a land surveyor and smuggle dozens of guns, swords, and other supplies to meet with his boys in the Kansas Territory. Once again, thank you so much for listening. The sources for today's podcast, once again, came from The Life and Letters of John Brown by Franklin Benjamin Sanborn, The Kansas Herald of Freedom out of Lawrence, Kansas in the 1800s, The Glasgow Weekly Herald out of Missouri, and An Englishman in Kansas by G.H. Gladstone. If you're enjoying today's podcast, don't be afraid to like, follow, subscribe on however you're listening. And again, you can always donate to the podcast through the Anchor homepage for John Brown's Body. Have a great day. I'll see you soon.
I look to the west and I look to the south. I saw Old Slavery a-coming. With four northern doorbreakers hitched up in front, driving freedom to the other side of Jordan. So take off your coats and roll up your sleeves. Slavery's a hard foe to battle. Take off your coats and roll up your sleeves. Slavery's a hard foe to battle.